Crime Obscene is a monthly true crime podcast. This episode contains potentially triggering topics of suicide and suicide ideation. Listener discretion is advised. On the night of Wednesday, 23rd of November, 2016, Tom Brown and some friends met at a middle school car park. An ordinary night filled with driving, listening to music, and big dreams to leave the small town of Canadian, Texas behind and to start their lives. Tom and friends, Christian and Caleb, bundle into Christian's car, and they drive around the town, stopping to go for a walk. Soon, it's 11 p.m. So the trio decide to call it a night. Christian drives the boys and herself back to the car park, where they get into their own cars. Caleb watches Tom get into his red Dodge Durango at 11:26 p.m. and drive away, not knowing this would be the last time he saw his friend. At the Brown residence, Tom's midnight curfew comes and goes without any sign of the 18-year-old, and Mother Penny begins to worry as it was very unlike him to be late. The minutes slowly trickle by, and after a few texts, Penny is advised by her husband, a voluntary firefighter, and Tom's stepfather, to ring a sheriff's dispatch. And after 45 minutes, a deputy responds, and the search begins for Thomas. What ensues from this night, and well into the days, weeks, and even years, is a truly bizarre and baffling case. A case where misinformation, 1,000 different stories and rumours attach themselves to a case already beset with issues such as private investigations and rumours of a cover-up. But behind the controversy and small-town gossip lies a heartbreaking case and questions that still remain unanswered. What happened to Thomas Kelly Brown, a young man who played football, video games, and was well-liked and a class president? How did his car come to be abandoned at a water treatment plant, his belongings scattered for miles beyond, and ultimately where his remains would be found 3 years later? In this episode, we explore the disappearance and eventual discovery of Tom Brown. Hello, you're very welcome to Crime Obscene. I'm your host, Aaron. Before we start, I would like to tell you a little about the show. Crime Obscene is a monthly true crime podcast that explores unsolved murders, missing persons cases, and beyond. This podcast is run by me and me alone, so your listenership and feedback is greatly appreciated. So why not give me a follow on your favourite podcatcher and a like and a review? This greatly helps out the pod. If you have any feedback, a case suggestion, or just want to drop me a line, you can do so at emailing me at crimeobscenepod@outlook.com, tweet me at crimeobscenepod, or on Instagram by the same name. There is also a private Facebook group set up where you can discuss your thoughts on episodes, recommend some other pods, or just be part of a community who want to make a difference. That's Crime Obscene Investigators at Facebook. Now, let's begin. Chapter 1, Crime Timeline. Thomas Kelly Brown was born September 13th, 1998, in Canadian, Texas, to parents Penny and Kelly Brown, and had one older brother named Tucker. Canadian is a small city in and the county seat of Hemphill County, Texas, United States. It is named after the Canadian River, with a population of just 2,649, according to the 2010 census. When Tom was 8, his parents divorced. He did open up to some of his friends about this difficult time and said it had made him question his fate, which he was very strong in. In his formative years, Tom excelled in school socially and formed a strong core group of friends. Coming from that into high school, he would go on to become a starter for the state championship Canadian high school football team. His teammates had all said he was a committed player, up until early into the academic year of his disappearance, where he would make the tough decision to leave the football team to pursue other academic areas. Among this, he was very interested in drama and acting. Tom became class president for 2 years, and the way students did this was by writing a speech and reading it to their class. Usually the funniest speech would win, so when Tom got up to read his, it was said he had everyone in tatters laughing. Though during this time, Tom had been going through some significant changes, some of which would be difficult for a young man. Along with stepping back from football, Tom had also broken up with his girlfriend, Sage, though this was stated as being amicable and the two had remained friends despite this. By all accounts, Tom was a funny and popular young man, who was described as being a superior student by teachers, one who was potentially destined for amazing things. Alas, on the evening of November 23rd, that would all change, and the sleepy and small town of Canadian, Texas would be changed forever. On that Thanksgiving Eve, everything seemed normal. Tom was planning to meet his friends Christian Webb and Caleb King and do what they often do, drive around and listen to music and talk. Generally what small town kids might do, ponder what life was like outside the confines of their much known and trodden backyards and experience new things. At about 6 p.m, Tom asks his mum could he borrow her debit card so that he could put gas in his car. Penny gives him the card, they say goodbye, and Tom left. Shortly thereafter, Tom meets Christian and Caleb at the Canadian Middle School parking lot. There Tom and Caleb have their respective cars parked and pile into Christian's car. They drive around before stopping at the Canadian Wagon Bridge, a rusted red disused rail bridge from the 1916s, now repurposed as a scenic hike and bike trail. 11 p.m. comes, and while Tom's curfew isn't until 12 a.m, the trio decide to call it a night. Christian drives the boys back to their vehicles, and Tom leaves at 11:26 in his red Dodge Durango. At 11:28 p.m, Tom is seen on surveillance pulling up to Frank's Oil, where bank records verify he puts gas in and Penny's card is swiped at this time. As 12 a.m. comes and goes, Tom misses his curfew. This strikes Penny as odd, and quoted in saying on ABC7 Amarillo Facebook livestream to the question, "At what point did you start to think this was unusual and start to panic?" Penny said, quote, "About 5 minutes after midnight. He wasn't my kid who missed curfew. Sometimes he would come home way before curfew, as his friends would get on their gaming stations and play games," end quote. It's at this point Penny tries to get in contact with Tom. Tucker sends a text to his brother's phone, and it delivers but is not read. At 10 after 12 a.m., Penny again texts Tom's phone with the same result. 5 minutes later, she tries again. However, this time, the text was undelivered and most likely meant Tom's phone was out of service or turned off. Tucker leaves the home and begins driving to see if he can find Tom's car anywhere. At 12:13 a.m, Tom's phone pings for the last time at 1513 Locust Street near Wildcat Stadium. Penny rings Christian, and upon learning Tom is missing, Christian calls Caleb, and the two begin a series of calls to their circle of friends. But when it is clear none of them have had contact with him, alarm intensifies, and the two friends decide to go out and search. Penny's husband is a volunteer fireman, so he gives Penny a contact number for the sheriff's office, and within 45 minutes a deputy arrives and begins to look for Tom. Tucker had gone to assist the deputy, and by daybreak, when they returned with no leads, Christian's father had gone up in a helicopter. Tom's red Dodge Durango is sighted after 8 a.m. at a water treatment plant 4 miles from Tom's home. The car was left abandoned with a window down and the doors unlocked, which is odd as families and friends describe Tom as always locking the doors and rolling up the windows. None of the things Tom had taken with him, like keys, backpack, which also contained his laptop, his phone, or most importantly, Tom himself, were found. It wouldn't be until much later in the investigation, it was learned that Tom's vehicle was recorded at several points throughout the early hours in the morning, with the latest shortly before 6 a.m. Tom's car had been seen on CCTV at Hemp Hill County Recreation Center. It turns onto North 2nd Street and heads east before entering the water treatment area, where it will be found abandoned hours later. Learning this, it is clear family and law enforcement were mere steps behind Tom, if not just separated by 3 hours. Chapter 2, Police Investigation, Short, Not Sweet. As relayed in the timeline segment, Tom's parents and friends began immediately afterwards felt something was wrong. In essence, they were right behind him. Despite not outwardly seeing signs of a struggle, further examination of the car revealed an empty 25 caliber bullet casing was found in the interior, along with a droplet of blood and a debit card, not the one belonging to Penny Meek, but a friend of Tom's, Michael Castletine. The exterior showed no other physical evidence, save for an area where someone had urinated. Tracking and scent dogs were brought in, recovering a scent, but it panned out shy of a marshy area approximately 1 mile east from where the truck was left. The car processed, it was returned to Penny on the same day it was recovered, with nothing but the bullet casing and the blood sampled, raising eyebrows to how meticulous the search of it all was. Penny, now frustrated with the apparent insufficient effort on behalf of the sheriff's office, hires a private investigator to run his investigations parallel with the current investigations with the police. Over the next week, tracking with search teams from around the panhandle unite their efforts to search for Tom. From police agencies at state and local governments to even private citizens using vehicles, the water treatment facility is drained of water, Canadian River is dragged, a nearby Lake Marvin is surveyed with sonar to no avail. As weeks slipped by, very little came in the way of clues, but 2 months into the search efforts, an electrical worker doing site work in the Lake Marvin area stumbled upon a weathered backpack on the other side of a fence. The bag was sodden and wet, consistent with being exposed to the elements. However, it was found in an upright position, and the family were not so confident it was there from the day of the disappearance. Feeling with how thorough the search of the area was, it had to have been placed sometime after the fact. When commenting on the state of the backpack, Sheriff Nathan Lewis said, quote, "There was an indentation on the ground, where it had been, wet inside and out, pages were molded at this point," end quote. The school-issued laptop Tom owned was also in the bag, though it had not been in use, therefore offering no sight into Tom's location. Penny was not told of this find until a week after it was recovered. Meanwhile, Penny had begun pushing on social media with the creation of Moms for Tom, a collaboration of mothers who were trying to get exposure for Tom's case. Alongside this, both Penny and Philip Klein, Penny's PI, make several appearances on local radio stations to speak about the investigation. Philip is not coy in stating he believes Tom's case is one of foul play, stating in one interview Philip conducted with a friend of Tom's, evil has come to Canadian. There is a quick note to be made about Nathan Lewis, which will be expanded on later in the podcast. It is stated that around the time Tom was 16 years of age, he and some friends were outside after 11 p.m. They were just walking around and talking, when a deputy pulled up beside them and accused them of breaking into a business. As Tom and boys were innocent and knew very well, they protested their innocence, but the deputy was hearing none of it. Allegedly, the deputy singled out Tom and asked him to get into the car, becoming belligerent with the young man, cursing. He threatened Tom with calling his mother, but Tom, again knowing very well he was innocent of anything, adamantly protested his innocence. Oddly, the deputy lets Tom out of the car and leaves without issue, This deputy was Nathan Lewis and would later become the sheriff. Chapter 3, Klein Investigation. During the subsequent time that local law enforcement was doing their own investigation, Penny had hired Klein Investigations, a private security firm headed by Philip Klein, whose own track record of high-profile cases include missing grandfather Michael Chambers and a missing Dior Coons child. Within a few days of Tom going missing, Penny called Klein's firm. She was very unhappy with law enforcement's response to her son's disappearance and wanted to get someone in who was unaffiliated with the local sheriff's department. Klein met with the local sheriff, Nathan Lewis, and according to Klein, Lewis was not happy to see him there at all. Klein advised Lewis he was called in by Penny to assist in investigative efforts, and he did not want to impede efforts, and to call him if Lewis felt like he was, to which Lewis only laughed and felt Klein was full of himself and a showboat. Unfortunately, this meeting would result in a back and forth rivalry of accusations. For the sake of respect for Tom and family, I will not delve into it in this podcast. What is solid from the meeting Klein got from the sheriff was that the local department felt it was a runaway or suicide situation, citing the lack of evidence of a struggle or from what they could ascertain from where the vehicle was left. Klein would immediately set out on the road, interviewing Tom's closest friends. Initially, all he would hear is the surface level information: student body president, hilarious personality, charming young man with the world ahead of him. But Klein, in his own words, was a profiler. He wanted details about Tom that maybe few would want to divulge, like risk factors. Did Tom do drugs, drink a lot, or hang out with less than savvy characters? Michael Castletine, if you remember, as being one of Tom's friends, who was cruising with him early in the day before Tom had gone out with Christian and Caleb, said, quote, "he may have drunk maybe 4 times in his life," end quote. On the face of it, there seemed to have been no risk factors in terms of alcohol. Klein had moved on and met with Caleb. He had asked Caleb about any other sexual identities or leanings maybe Tom had had. This was more than likely to see if Tom had led a double life that may have contributed to his disappearance in either voluntary or involuntary, but Caleb denied any of this. Moving forward, it would be worth noting here that it was discovered and disclosed very early on in the investigation that Tom did in fact have a more secretive side to him. Lewis had learned in the investigation from Sage Pennington, Tom's ex-girlfriend, that Tom had admitted he wore adult diapers. Penny had stated an incident occurred when Tom was still in middle school, where someone in the family had walked in on Tom as he was wearing them. She thought it had stopped then, as he had never worn them or mentioned them around the family again. Some have used these details to try and distort Tom's image, to make him out to be some deviant, and distract from the fact that Tom is an innocent young man whose life is not devalued in any way due to the life choices that others may cast judgment upon. Only a handful of people in Tom's life had known about this fact. Sage and Christian Webb, who said he had opened up about it in 2016 before she went to college. This would prompt investigators to question if Tom did in fact lead a double life. But Sage said Tom was a regular guy who had broke up with her in his regular sweet way. She was attending college that Tom wouldn't be near. This knowledge, investigators learned, had put a fork in the road for the two investigative agencies who were tending to Tom's disappearance. Whilst Lewis was under the suspicion that Tom had walked away from his life or had committed suicide, Klein had come to a very different conclusion. He believed Tom had been murdered. Klein pointed out the fact that Tom's body had still not been recovered at this time, and the fact that his belongings were recovered so scattered miles from his Dodge Durango. In July 2017, 8 months since Tom had gone missing, Penny held a press conference in which she requested the local sheriff's office relinquish control of the case to the Attorney General's office, citing reasons, quote, "navigating the various law enforcement agencies has proven to confuse us, frustrate us, and leave us questioning much about the way the investigation has begun and continues," end quote. Lewis was at the press conference and spoke briefly, assuring everyone the case was still being actively investigated, but refused to call it a criminal investigation. Tips did not stop flowing in for Klein during this time. Some of them were from the benign. Thomas was spotted having quesadillas with a couple out in New Mexico. To the ludicrous, Tom was now a professional wrestler out in North Carolina. This was most likely due to a mounting reward that had been offered by local donations. September had come, however, now 9 months on, and a tip was called in. A young woman had come forward from Canadian and spoke about something only investigators had known, making what she claimed next to be rather credible. She overheard conversation that Tom's body had been placed in the area of Lake Marvin Road, also where his backpack had been recovered. This prompted a search to take place on October 14th, headed by Klein, with a group of 135 volunteers who were divided into groups and advised to look for any of Tom Brown's belongings. And because a shell was found for a 22 caliber gun, this was also to be on the lookout. And of course, as wildlife may have already been present for some time, human remains in the form of bones. No stone would be left unturned. A slow and arduous search to follow in the sun. The media, who were also present, capturing every minute, waiting with Canadian, holding its collective breath. What was shocking about this search though, a mere 6 minutes into it, something was found in the grass. An iPhone. A rose gold iPhone. A similar colour as to one Tom had owned. What made this more astounding, and to make even Klein question whether it was in fact Tom's phone or not, was that it was in very good condition. Klein had stated in an interview later, it was like it was, quote, out of the box new, end quote. The grass had been freshly mowed that week, and the phone had not looked like it had passed through a lawnmower, and with rain in recent weeks, there was no sign of water damage. Regardless of how new the phone looked, it was still sent to the FBI for analysis. Among other materials found was a gun case, perhaps which could have held a 22 pistol, but overall nothing else of note was found. In January 2018, the FBI lab had been delayed up to this point, and they had finally gotten to examine the phone and concluded it did in fact belong to Tom. This shocked the Klein team, and the way it had been found so quickly in almost mint condition, it was fair to surmise it had been placed not very long before the search had begun. This raised a lot of questions, like why was his phone there? Had it been planted? And if so, by whom? Klein was convinced it had been planted in a way to almost derail the investigation, to perhaps distract from the search. The phone had been a subject of strangeness for Penny for a while now. As she recalled in early days of investigation, Sheriff Nathan Lewis had inquired about the passcode for Tom's phone, for which she did not have. This begged the question, why Lewis needed this was also strange. At this point, no one had found the phone, so it was no real use to have the passcode anyway. Klein also stated he had not disclosed the location of the search to people directly involved until it was 48 hours beforehand, and he also claimed Lewis knew the area of the search all along. Lewis also had his suspicions that maybe Klein had planted the phone, and that perhaps Penny had the phone and she planned this with him. All of this was speculation on both Lewis and Klein's part. I will not dwell too long on this section, as it goes along with the bitter rivalry I mentioned earlier in the episode. A Mom for Tom Facebook group, shortly after the phone had been identified, posted a petition for the Attorney General's office to take over the case, and in a surprise move, the Sheriff's Office agreed and wanted the Attorney General to take over the case too. And within 2 weeks, members of the crime unit would come to Canadian and start their own investigation. Chapter 4, The Attorney General's Investigation. The AGA's crime unit investigators, Rachel Kading and Chris Smith, dove headfirst into the complex case out of the small town of Canadian. Penny, Tom's older brother Tucker, and Penny's husband Chris were called in 2018 to meet with them. The meeting was a rundown of events, since Nathan Lewis had allegedly approached Tom that night up to the time where he disappeared. This also led investigators asking the three of them would they want to submit to a polygraph. With nothing to hide, they felt they could do one. Unfortunately, there was problems with the polygraph. When Penny went to do her one in March, Kading and Smish had not disclosed if she had failed or not, and began grilling her, saying she knew more than she was letting on. Their working theory was Penny knew about Tom's suicide, and embarrassed of the history of suicides in her family, Penny moved his body. This led to a visceral and physical reactions from both Penny and her husband, Chris. They were so upset by the polygraph sessions turned interrogations, they vowed not to take one again. Tucker, now wary of his turn, declined to take a polygraph as well, as the horrible situation it had brought on his mother. This probe did not stop with Penny. It would soon land on not only Nate and Lewis, but Klein too. Nathan had conceded to taking a polygraph, but in questions where a yes or no answer is needed, if asked, quote, "Were you involved in Tom's disappearance?" end quote, for a senior investigation in the case who has been embroiled in the investigation from day one, answering yes or no insinuates guilt of party and not the context that Nathan would desire it to be, that he is involved because of the fact he is investigating. After answering no, the polygrapher registers his response as deceit, at which point Lewis ended the test. Klein allegedly had an easier time, and once passing his test promptly, he put the two investigators in their place. He told them to stop wasting their time on polygraphing innocent people and to go, quote, "investigate homicide," end quote. The months rolled on in their investigation, with little being revealed. Penny wasn't privy to any of the details of the investigation, and it seemed the two of them were falling behind like so many others in their place. It wouldn't be long, however, until one day, in January 2019, as Deputy Officer Pine Gregory, the same officer Tucker had been out with searching that night. Gregory was out on patrol, where he pulled over to an area to look for some antler bones. What Gregory found was following a trail into a thicket would finally bring the end of nearly 2 years of misery for Penny and her loved ones, but bring no more answers. Chapter 5, The Body. 2 years since Tom Brown had vanished on Thanksgiving, a skull had been discovered by chance at the end of Lake Marvin Road. Gregory called it in, and shortly thereafter, Texas Rangers and Attorney General's office confirmed through forensic testing it had been in fact Thomas Kelly Brown. Klein commented on the fact that even though the area was searched, quote, "that area had been flown by helicopters, the south part of the area. The north had not been missed, but rather it had not been searched yet," end quote. The condition of Tom was of course skeletal. In fact, only the skull, a femur, and a few smaller bones were recovered, along with some remnants of jeans, a tennis shoe, and a partially chewed driver's license that could only just barely read Tom's full name. But ultimately what this meant was, after 2 long years of searching, Tom was finally found and could be laid to rest. Tom's funeral was held in the gym of the high school which he attended, and as this was the only place in the town big enough to hold all the attendees that wanted to come. If rumours and gossip had been a problem in the small town of Canadian and impeded lives and investigations alike, 2 weeks after Tom's remains were found, it skyrocketed. Unfortunately, the father of Michael Castletine had been found dead in his car of a self-inflicted gunshot. Speculation ramped up. Armchair detectives and keyboard sleuths alike all triumphantly proclaimed this obviously has something to do with Tom, but this was further from the truth. Jeff Castletine was a well-liked teacher and Canadian. He had suffered with depression and bipolar for most of his life, and he was sick at the time. The sad thing about all this was, the media frenzy that swallowed up an already overwhelming tragedy was now enveloping another family's grief, and it seemed the whole town would surely explode. In August 2019, Penny Meekan family were invited to a meeting attended by the AG investigators, Hemphill County Sheriffs, Texas Ranger, District Attorney and private investigators, and in that meeting they were all informed, due to the lack of evidence, the Attorney General's office would suspend the investigations. To note, this didn't mean it would be classed a cold case and was still classed as an open investigation. utter contents to this meeting, which was not expanded upon at the time until the media had broken it, once again proved to be a vicious cycle. It was the misinformation. The Office of the Attorney General, whilst not directly citing that they believed Tom killed himself, they felt evidence was pointing in this direction. Elaborating further, criminal investigator for the AG, Chris Smith, said, quote, "He had a lot of stuff going on. When you add all of these elements together, can I say 100% that's not the case? No, I cannot say that, but I can tell you that that's what the evidence suggests for us," end quote. He furthered in saying that what they were trying to do was put a logical explanation to an illogical situation, saying, quote, "We can't explain what someone is thinking when they do that. I can tell you in that, in my experience, someone who's going to commit suicide, nobody knows until they're actually found dead," end quote. But when asked, does this mean they're ruling it a suicide, Smith answered, "They do not rule anything," explaining that it would be up to the medical examiner to rule on any case or manner of death. Quote, "What we will say is obviously there were remains found," said Cady. "Those remains did not provide any information as to what happened, other than he is deceased," end quote. In response to further questions, Cading explained that only a portion of Tom's remains were found, attributing to the animal activity and the length of time, over 2 years, that the body was exposed to the elements. Quote, "We had sufficient evidence that there was a body there, pieces of clothing and things like that," end quote. Investigators confirm no suicide note was found, they still cannot find enough evidence to corroborate murder. In response to all this, in November 2019, Klein posted a very lengthy status to their Facebook page. In that, they emphatically disagree with the findings of the Attorney General, citing many reasons. The AG was allegedly not confident in Klein's handling of the investigation, citing numerous problems such as luminol tests Klein did on Tom's Dodge Durango. In this status, Klein representatives state, quote, "Good morning. We would like to announce that we have completed the overview of the evidence, interviews, and timelines regarding the Thomas Brown case. As the anniversary of his death comes in 2 weeks, we want to speak to you, the public, regarding such. We know what we will say is going to be controversial. However, we must be upfront and honest. 1. We humbly disagree with the findings of the OAG regarding any suggestions of suicide. We have reviewed the evidence and we simply do not see this. However, we continue to gather information regarding this theory. 2. We are treating this case as a homicide. We firmly believe that the evidence points to this. Today, we released luminol photos and tests that we completed inside Tom's car," end quote. On Tuesday, November 12th, 2019, Sheriff Nathan Lewis resigned. The Texas Commission of Law Enforcement, or TCOL, investigated a Hemphill County Sheriff of submitting falsified records, specifically about training reports. However, it was believed he had allegations against him by two deputies who called into question how he conducted Tom's investigation in 2016. An officer named Klopp had said it wasn't outside the realm of Lewis fabricating a document because he had manufactured a supplement for a missing persons a year and a half ago, then specifically mentioned the Thomas Brown case, quote, "because we've been through the Tom Brown mess. On that deal, he manufactured a supplement a year and a half after the fact," end quote. In June 2020, Klein Investigations once again went to their Facebook page and released a public statement, only this time announcing prosecution phase of the case would begin towards the middle or end of the year, though it would likely be with COVID, those plans may have changed. They did not give any further details in the post. At this point of the episode, my usual way to end would go through my own interpretation of the material I have researched and where the facts of the case leads me to speculate. However, this case rocked me very hard, not only from the outstanding number of theories already available if you do one Google of Tom Brown's name, but just what one can do with what is available in the public domain. What I truly think is, speculation and rumour hurt this case. The rumour mill spun and spun until there was nothing left for any one person to sit down and have a look and try to unwind the mess that has been knotted in hypotheticals and speculation. To that end, I'm not going to weigh in on any of my own theories, which would be by and large uneducated, as I am not an investigator or ever taught myself to be one. Tom Brown could have been a good friend of mine. Hell, I would have been lucky to have such a bright soul as his in my life. Something happened to Tom. Something happened to Canadian. And really, as this is an active investigation, I do hope answers come from it, and that one day we learned what happened to this young man just starting out his life.
I kind of feel like we're still on square one. I still feel like we're on November 23rd, 2016. We still have questions. We still do not have answers. And so there's really no moving forward. There's no healing. I just have to keep believing that someday I'll have answers. And, you know, maybe it's not until I go to heaven. I don't know. But I'm still going to be hopeful. Maybe I don't hope that Thomas is coming home anymore. He's already home. But I can still hope that we have answers. They said that it was undetermined, is the word they used.
The most difficult part for her is not that the case is no longer considered active. It is that she doesn't know when his remains will be returned.
They'll remain, I guess, in a lab somewhere. So I think that's one of the harder things, is that you don't ever feel like you can really put him to rest.
Now, the case is not closed or cold. It is still active, but now suspended. That means if new evidence is found.